Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Lisa C. is well known to readers far and wide for finding stories of our past that we likely know little about, and she's done it again. Her latest book is Daughters of the Sun and Moon, a story about an 1870s massacre of Chinese immigrants in what was then a very gritty and dangerous and small Los Angeles. Lisa C., welcome. It's nice to see you again.
It's so nice to see you again and talk with you again.
You know, every time we talk, I ask you about your book reading habits. Are you still reading books backwards?
Well, it's backwards and forwards. I read the first chapter and then the last chapter and then the second chapter and then the penultimate chapter. And yes, I still do that. And I don't always finish the book because sometimes I get, about a third each way and think, yeah, I got the idea.
Do you feel guilty when you don't finish a book?
Not at all.
No, not at all, huh? Why is it that you do it that way?
You know, I think this goes back to all the way when I was a little kid reading chapter books. You know, like when you first start reading chapter books, I'm going to say, what is that, maybe third grade? And I couldn't go to sleep unless I knew that everybody was going to be okay in the story.
Interesting.
And so I just had to know how it was going to end. And then I could go back to the beginning and just read at a leisurely pace. But otherwise, you know, I'd be awake all night. And that is true now, too, that if I don't know that that everyone's going to be okay or the people that I care about, or if they aren't going to be okay, I need to know that, too. So I'm kind of prepared. But I will say that this weird habit that I have has actually really helped me as a writer.
How's that?
I also write the last sentence first, so that I know where I'm going. And, as you know, a lot of things, bad things happen to characters in my books. And right. So I just want to know where they're going to end up. And I actually can't start writing until I have the last scene in my head. Once I have the last sentence, then I can start at page one. But the other thing I think about having done the, reading first chapter, last chapter, since I was whatever, 8, 9 years old, is that it's really taught me a lot about the structure of books and where, and it doesn't have to be a mystery to need clues mm-hmm. of what's going to happen. So how you do that and where things get laid in and how you think about character development and plot, I think all of my skills go back to this weird reading habit that I had since a child.
You write the book to be read from forward to back, right?
I do. I do. But whenever I mention that I write the last sentence first, certainly in a book event, there's a big audience and I say that, everybody turns to the last page.
To read the last sentence. I don't think I would do that. I'd like to be surprised maybe. Is it getting easier for you?
No.
Harder?
I don't know if it's getting harder. I've actually been thinking about this quite a bit because I've just started doing the research for the next book. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there's something that we, continue to learn. No matter what you do, you continue to learn, you continue to improve your skills. You also are growing older and acquire a certain amount, what one hopes, of wisdom. And so in many ways, my perspective on life has changed since, when I first started writing. My knowledge about certain things has certainly expanded, but I think that also means that I want to go deeper and continue to go deeper and think more about human experience, human emotions, and bring I feel like I've been pretty good at that over the years.
I think you have. I think the record shows that's probably true, Lisa.
But growing older and having more experience, it makes me want to do, like I just said, you know, go deeper about how people go through life.
We're in difficult, divisive times right now, and I want to touch on that a little deeper later. But growing up as you did in a biracial family, does that allow you or make you see the American experience differently than me growing up in just a white family?
I think so. I mean, your listeners can't see me. I have red hair and freckles, but I grew up in a very large Chinese American family. I lived with my mom, and her family was tiny. There were only about 10 people in her family when I was little, and today there are three left. I'm one of them. My father's side of the family when I was little was huge. In Los Angeles alone, about 400 relatives.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, there was a spectrum of how people looked. You know, there's a small percentage of people who looked like me, and all the way, you know, the majority still full Chinese, and then this spectrum in between. And so when we would gather, and, you know, Chinese tradition, there are lots of ceremonies and holidays and things like that. So we'd gather together quite a bit. But as a child, again, I lived with my mom, but I spent a tremendous amount of time with my father's family. And so, you know, what I experienced was Chinese culture, Chinese tradition, Chinese language, Chinese food. And that is why I write the kinds of books that I do. But again, I don't look Chinese. And so I do feel in many ways that my books, it's like I'm on an edge, right? I look this way. I was raised that way. And part of what I'm doing is trying to explain to myself who I am. Where do I fit in? But that also has made me very sensitive to issues of race, but race, gender, ethnicity that are so much a part of America today, and some of those divisive issues that you mentioned, but also we have this very deep, long record of that. And so I can't say that I have total insight, but that it's a journey for me to think about those issues and think about where I fit in, where I don't fit in, what's my experience, what was the experience of even my father. So I look at it that way.
The long history that you refer to is certainly exposed in Daughters of the Sun and Moon. And I think I know the answer to this story, but tell me how it is that you found this story.
So I actually wrote a little bit about the Chinese massacre of 1871 in my first book, On Gold Mountain, which was a nonfiction book that told the history of the Chinese in America through the eyes of my family. It was maybe two paragraphs. And the reason it was in there was that my great-grandparents came to Los Angeles. Is it a direct result? In part because of what had happened here. So in 1871, 10% of the population of Los Angeles rises up, shoots, stabs, and hangs 10% of the Chinese. So 18 Chinese men and boys were killed. And afterwards, and this became international news. Mm-hmm. It happened about 10 days after the Chicago fire. It pushed the Chicago fire off of the front page around the world. And this was a time of the land boom. It was just beginning in Los Angeles, and city fathers wanted to erase what had happened off the physical map and also the sort of what we could call the map of memory of what had happened. So it wasn't long after what was called the Night of Horrors that the street was obliterated, the buildings were torn down, and it was just gone. And so again, city fathers sold this place, Los Angeles, as a place of optimism, opportunity where anyone could come from anywhere in the world. We had sunshine, good health, all the things that we still sell today.
But it was, it was created by them.
Yeah, I mean, it was created. I mean, it was a marketing plan.
Yeah, LA was not that when they
was not to, that yet. Yeah, but it was marketed that way. And my great-grandparents bought it. They bought that sales pitch because they were a mixed race couple when it was against the law for Chinese and white people to be married here in California, was against the law in 28 states. And they needed a place where they felt they would be safe and that their children would be safe. So where they settled and where they had their family store when they first came to Los Angeles, and they were there for decades, was a literal stone's throw from where the massacre began. I mean, I could throw that rock, okay, like a literal stone, a literal stone thrown by Lisa.
did I read, though, somewhere that your grandmother walked you to the spot?
Yeah, right, but she would never talk about the massacre necessarily. I mean, I don't think ever that I remember, but she would take me to where this store was. Okay. And where the family had lived. And actually, my grandparents and my dad, during the Depression, lived in the basement of that building. So this was, you know, really where my family had gotten its start in Los Angeles. The fact that she never mentioned what had happened there, I think, is pretty telling, actually.
It is amazing that the message of, you know, live out your dreams in L.A. that started then is what's still being sold now, right? So many of us.
Exactly.
My daughter went to LA to make her way. I mean, she followed that example, I guess.
Yeah.
You tell this story through three women. Oh, the other thing I want to bring up, and we can do it when we talk about of the women, but it was after the Civil War that this happened, but it was still legal to own Chinese women in California.
That's correct.
That's astounding to me. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So after the Civil War, you know, we have the 13th Amendment. Slavery is outlawed. There was an exception, and it had to do with the sale and ownership of Chinese women in California. And that didn't finally end until about 1875. They passed something called the Page Act. It still took a little while to free these women, but it's something that I think is not known widely that happened here. And writing about that, I just felt, I don't know how to say this without sounding like a total egomaniac or something, but I wanted to bring that piece of history out.
Well, that's
that
it's
was
phenomenal.
Like my responsibility to, like, I feel sometimes a responsibility to share this history that we didn't learn in school.
One of your principal characters is in Servitude.
Yeah.
Tell me about her.
Yeah, Petal is actually inspired by two real women, Sing Ye and Sing Yi, two real women with very similar names who were sold by their families in China, brought here, and then sold into prostitution. And the reason that I know their names is from the moment they got here, they did everything they could to escape and find freedom. And so every time they would escape, they'd be caught and brought into court and given back to their owners. And so there are court records that exist, and even in some cases, some newspaper accounts of what happened to these two women. So I took the experiences of those two women to create the character of Petal, who has that same story, sold by her family, sold into prostitution, and then really does everything she can to escape and find freedom.
Dove wasn't really sold into servitude, but she was into an arranged marriage to go become a second wife to a merchant in China.
In Los Angeles.
Common, tell me about her role in the story.
Well, she too is based on a real woman named Yet Ho, who again was sent to Los Angeles. She was 15 years old in an arranged marriage, to a much older merchant, and he was described in the local press as being hideously ugly. Anyway, she wasn't here for very long before she was kidnapped and held captive for about 6 months. Mm. And at the time, newspaper reporters, but also even today, there are many scholars, or most scholars, believe that her kidnapping is the initial spark for what will set the massacre into motion.
And then there's Moon, who is the fighter for justice, right?
Yes, and she was the wife of the Chinese doctor here in Los Angeles. His name was Dr. Tong. And actually, I knew the least least about her. There's not a whole lot in the historic record about her. She was there. I don't want to give too much away. All of a sudden, no. I thought, oh, there's going to be some spoilers here, so I'm going to be very careful.
You know, but, I did that once, just not too long ago. An author, I was talking to him, and he was going to write a second book about this. And one of the central characters, I said, oh, will he be in it? Well, it was a terrible question to ask, because his fate was at risk throughout the entire book, right? So mm-hmm. Now, had we read it Lisa C's way, we would know what happened to this character, but... not the case. Okay, so don't give too much away, but tell me about Moon.
Yeah, I'm sorry if you were hearing that my computer, I didn't realize that my email was still on. I just turned it off, so you shouldn't hear that anymore.
That's okay. My neighbor's mowing his yard, so if you hear the mower, just ignore that too.
So let's see. There wasn't a whole lot about her in the historic record, but I took what there was to help build out this character. And so her husband was the Chinese doctor in Los Angeles. Again, you know, this is not long after the end of the Civil War. Western medicine was really primitive, but Chinese medicine had already been around for a couple thousand years. And actually throughout the West, in small towns, there often were traditional Chinese medicine doctors, because people preferred to go to someone like that than a snake oil salesman mm-hmm. or someone who was going to, you know, saw off your leg. So Dr. Tong had a small practice right in what we could call Chinatown, although it wasn't officially a Chinatown yet. And then he also had an office, a clinic in the main part, or the white part of town. He spoke four languages. He was very well respected, wore Western style clothing, a diamond ring, and he was the second person to be hung. And what his wife did after that was to seek justice for him and for other people. And so, again, there's one court record that has survived that helped me to create her story. One other piece about her is that after the massacre, one of the survivors of this terrible thing that happens, all the looting, all the destruction of this one particular building where she and her husband lived, is that their little white poodle survived. And one of the big questions for me was, how did that little white poodle get to Los Angeles mm-hmm. in 1870? And it's one of those things that has just fascinated me from the first time I saw it in different newspaper reports. It was like, where did that little white poodle come from?
And so there were convictions out of this, right? And
yes.
Then there was a court fight to overturn those convictions, which they were. And that fight was led by this man, fascinates me. Is it Widney or Whitney? Robert M.
I believe Whitney. Yeah. He was the judge in the trials, in the initial trials. He was such a fascinating person. He was part of this vigilante committee that had been very active in Los Angeles. Los Angeles was extremely violent and was considered to be one of the most violent, if not the most violent, of all of the Wild West towns. And so there was this vigilante committee that had their way of dealing with people that they sure. didn't like, right? Sure. You know, so there were a lot of impromptu lynchings in in Los Angeles. But over time, he distanced himself from this vigilante committee. He became the first real estate agent in Los Angeles. On the night of the massacre, he personally saved many Chinese and put, you know, got them to safety, put them in hiding. He testified at the inquest. He was there for the grand jury, a witness. And then, weirdly enough, he's appointed the judge. And he, this was his first case. He didn't have a lot of experience. And the lawyers on the defense, I think, realized that. He went on later to become one of the founders of the University of Southern California, USC. And so he's just a very interesting personality.
There's a, I mean, it's fascinating because, you know, do we talk about, is there a second act or is there redemption? And, you know, he's a character that would be ripe for that debate. There's another book out recently by Clay Kane. It's called Burn Down Master's House. A very good book. And I can't remember the name of the lawyer now, but it's a similar situation where this woman and her daughters were, they were slaves, but they lived in Pennsylvania for 6 months, and that should have allowed them to be free. And the lawyer who fought against that and put her back into slavery, she was enslaved again, later went to Congress and became a great abolitionist.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I don't know, the Widner, I think there's a similarity there with Widner too, and it just shows that, you know, life is long.
Life is long, people change.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm interested in the idea that the 1871 massacre is in some ways telling a story of the 2026 America. And I want your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I started this a few years ago. When I started it, we were just coming out of COVID and all the anti-Asian hate that came out during that period.
Right.
You know, ICE, the big ICE raids that we have seen had not happened yet. You know, so obviously I wasn't thinking about 2020, what was going to be happening in 2026. Sure. I couldn't have foretold that. What I will say is that these issues about race and the divisiveness just generally have been here all along. And I think of just, you know, I live in Los Angeles, so I'm going to talk about that. You know, after this 1871 massacre that's basically about race, we think it's never going to happen again. And then we had the Watts riots in the 1960s. After that, it's never going to happen again. And then you jump forward to what happens after the Rodney King trial. And we say it's never going to happen again. But it does happen again. And what I hope is it's somewhere along the line we can learn from our mistakes and learn from this history. Can we? I don't know. I think we can for short periods of time, and then people forget, or we. And I just happened to have a lunch with a group of women yesterday who were very high-powered in each of their professions, and a quite diverse group of women, about a dozen of us. And one of the things a couple of these were business women who were saying the struggles that they went through back in the 70s, you know, when they were the first CEO of their company, they're now seeing with this the generation of women going through corporate stuff today that, you know, they're hitting a glass ceiling, they're being fired, they're being laid off. Issues of DEI, you know, are being attacked right now.
Sure.
So, you know, what these women were saying was that all that stuff is still in people, and then if they're given an opportunity to let it out. And I think that's what's happening now, and this is happening, you know, where I'm not saying that people, what am I trying to say? That there was a pretty long period where people monitored what they said, and they were pretty careful about what they said. But we now have models in this country for, do you just say whatever you want to say, and if it's hateful and hurtful and results in terrible things, knock yourself out. And hopefully we will cycle through that again, learn from it for a period of time, but what will happen down the line, I can't say.
You know, it seems to me, and going back to what you were saying a few minutes ago, that this, well, I'm not going to say the solution, because it'd be a multifaceted solution, but one of our problems is we don't accept the fact that stories like the 1871 massacre occurred, or you start to think people are blaming you for what people did 150 years ago. That's not the case. I think once we accept that these things happened, and just accept them, it will be easier to move forward. While we continue to sort
accept
of deny
it and to
them,
learn from it. Yeah. You know, I think denying, and we're seeing a trend in the South of removing the history of slavery from high school textbooks. This isn't helping anything. You know, that doesn't move us forward as a country.
Speaking of monuments, you're working on a monument for the massacre?
Yes, I've been on I was on the mayor's original advisory committee, and now I'm on the board of the foundation that is raising money for the massacre, for the memorial. The money has been raised, which is wonderful. The memorial should be up by the 2028 Olympics.
Oh, great. When I'm visiting my daughter, I will make sure I find it.
Yes. I mean, they haven't broken ground yet, so you always get a little nervous. Until that first shovel goes into the ground, you don't know what's really going to happen. But
That's like life, Lisa, until that first shovel goes in.
Exactly.
Lisa C. is the author of Daughters of the Sun and Moon and so much more, and I consider her a friend. We've talked so many times.
We have.
Great to talk to you again today, and you look great. Are you in your house? Are you in your library?
I am. This is my office.
So this is an audio podcast.
And these are all research books all around me.
So there's hundreds of books around you.
Yep.
And they're all
scary. Yeah. And they're in other rooms too. So.
Well, it was great to talk to you again. I really appreciate you making time for us, and congratulations on Daughters of the Sun and Moon.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful chatting with you again.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you are. And you can subscribe if you would. You can subscribe at Apple Podcasts or Spotify, WGNRadio.com, just about anywhere you want. You can pick it up. And I hope you do, because I enjoy the conversations. I think the authors enjoy the conversations. And I think you would too. Or you can send me an email and yell at me for my questions for Lisa C. at SteveBertrandOnBooks@gmail.com. Lisa, be well. I hope to talk again.
For the next book.
All right.
See you soon, or when you come to visit your daughter in Los Angeles.
I'll see you at the monument.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
That'll wrap things up for this week. Thanks very much for tuning in, and I look forward to hearing from you and talking at you next time.